All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 45 of the SLS Cast. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, doing my best Good Morning Vietnam thing that I could think of while celebrating episode 45, the episode that brings us back into our roots from being from Houston, or at least broadcasting from Houston, and whilst broadcasting simultaneously from Los Angeles with a Houstonian transplant, we can go knowing that 45 is a Houston episode, because everyone's heard of the Houston Astros, but not everybody knows that they were established as the Houston Colt 45s back in 1962. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, when they even broke ground on the Astrodome. They didn't even use shovels at the ceremonial groundbreaking. No, no, no. They fired Colt 45s into the ground. Don't worry, they were using blanks. But still, I thought that was kind of a nice little touch of history and a little bit of fun.
Oh, wow.
For our episode 45.
I was about to say, that would not be safe whatsoever.
No.
Like, talk about Ricochet. They would have to be called the Ricochet team after whatever atrocity that would come after that.
Well, it didn't seem to do a whole hell of a lot of good. Because as soon as the Astrodome opened, they went and changed their name to the Astros.
Because of NASA and shit.
Well, yeah, because of NASA and everything, Space City. So you take what you can get, I suppose. That's kind of how it is. I am Matt, for anyone who didn't realize that already.
And I am the Los Angeles transplant from Houston, Tim.
Yeah. So, how you been doing this last week, sir?
I've been doing well. I've been reading some regular news, opposed to like bombarding myself with a bunch of movie news and whatnot lately, and I came across something that was interesting, and you know how a couple weeks ago I was talking about the Jackie Chan world, or JC world, over in Asia somewhere?
Yes.
Where exactly?
Yes, I do recall hearing all about that.
Well, a week or so later, it turns out that Tokyo will have an Iron Man exhibit, like an Iron Man themed section of, I don't know if it's like the Tokyo Disneyland or something like that. Well, it was just announced this week, or maybe it was this past week or past weekend, one of those things, I'll just say mid-October, that James Cameron's Avatar will now have its own area, its own piece of land there at Disney World in Florida. They're going to build Pandora, so they're going to have like their own like fireworks, nighttime show,
well, that would make
and
sense.
Stuff like yeah, that.
As a Disney file. They had a big, huge thing planned when they were originally building the Animal Kingdom. And they had various sections that they have Africa, they have Nepal, they have Dino Land USA, and so on and so forth. So they were trying to show, and then of course, you know, like the savannas and stuff. So they were trying to show not just having fun at Disney World, but also, and not just the Disneyfication of animals, but to actually kind of give you an idea in a Disney setting what the world's various I've never heard of that word, but whatever, we'll go with it, various animal areas are like around the world. And so that's why they had these things themed out. However, they also wanted to give, to pay homage, if you will, and respect to the mythical animal kingdoms that have influenced the way that man has interacted with animals in the real world. And when they were building Animal Kingdom, they came up and figured out, holy shit, this thing's going to be expensive. Even for Disney, it was going to be expensive. So they backed off on the building of mythical, I think it was going to be called like Dragonland or something like that. And when it first opened, people could see the area that had been initially planned for it had like some dragon stuff kind of carved into it. And there was definitely some stuff that they were beginning to work on. And they just kind of stripped it and turned it into Camp Mini Mickey, I think is what it's called. So they just kind of have a little mini themed area in the center that isn't being used to its fullest, but still allows for fun and Disney fun and all that good stuff.
Lame Disney fun when there could have been dragons.
That's right, there could have been dragons. But this, as I understand it, is where they're planning on doing the Avatar stuff.
Okay.
So that this way they can further James Cameron's thing about conservation and everything, and still have technology and still make it Disney.
I bet they're lucky now that the dragon thing didn't work out.
I guess like, so. I mean, they could have done a whole lot of stuff with like Mulan and whatever.
Mulan.
Isn't like Eddie Murphy a talking dragon in that one?
He is, yeah. He's the little talking creature, and it seems like a lot of black people are stereotyped in animated movies. They're like the little goofy creature with the overzealous characteristics and very hyperactive and full of pop culture references.
Well, good to know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, minus Robin Williams, but I guess he could be misconstrued as a black person sometimes because he has a lot of hair. A whole lot of hair.
What has that got to do with anything?
The color. It's dark brown hair.
Okay. Gotcha.
He's
all right.
Misconstrued as an African or a vagina from the 1970s.
I very am not pulpy. Following you down that rabbit hole. Other than to say the words rabbit hole.
Oh, wow.
So, anything fun and exciting happening for you in the last week?
Fun and exciting.
Really? No, actually, we recorded last Thursday, didn't we?
We did. So it's been...
So it's only been like 5 days.
Right.
Because it's Tuesday now.
That is true, yeah. So there's been a lot of editing going on. Oh, I found a cheapish Mexican restaurant, which is interesting. And it's the most Mexican-looking Mexican restaurant I've been to here in L.A. And you go in there and it feels like you're in a little Mexican village. You know, you see the tops of the huts and all that stuff coming through the walls. And you go to the bathroom and you walk through the two little squeaky Western doors. Like, literally, you walk through and it's like,
squeaky!
And you go in and you go pee, and the stalls are made of this really dark-looking oak wood right there, so if there was an earthquake or a tornado, you know to hide in those bathrooms because you are surrounded by all this oakiness. But then you go to the urinal there, and it's a huge-ass urinal, and they have pictures. They have two urinals, so you have a picture for each urinal. And those are the most sinister-looking urinal pictures I have ever seen. One urinal picture, the one that I went to, had a guy, and again, this was all, they're all Mexicans, I guess, and he was getting assassinated. This was from like the 1920s it looked like, and this guy had a shotgun that was right to this guy's head who's laying down on a dirt gravel road or whatever, and he's about to get executed, and his brains
was
are about
Pancho
to...
Villa?
I wish I knew that, because it would have made so much more sense if they had like a little description there on the bottom instead of just going in there like, holy crap. So I took some pictures of it. And the other one was another guy getting executed, and he was kind of up against a wall, kind of like doing the Jesus pose. Like he looked like he was crucified, but I don't know if he was or not. It was the weirdest stuff. And there were families in there. And
it's like your own version of Parks and Recreation and the murals that they have in City Hall that are... all politically incorrect.
Yeah, very suggestive. And what's also crazy is that not only is the Mexican restaurant the most Mexican looking, but that place contains some of the most good looking, stunningly attractive waitresses and hostesses that I've ever seen, both young and older. So it's weird. It's like there's something behind the sinister urinal pictures that's retaining the youth of the patrons and the staff of Beer and Salsa. And that's what the place is called. It has a very literal name to it. Salsa and Beer. Very misleading.
So you're telling me it should be entitled Salsa, Beer, Scary Murals, and Hot Waitresses?
I don't know. I mean, definitely...
Or maybe... Oh, what's the word I'm trying to think? Señoritas Caliente?
It could be, or it could just be Salsa, Beer,
and Death.
Written on the bottom. It's very sinister.
Salsa, cerveza, es muerte.
Yeah. It's like that moment.
Hey, Spanish is pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad. Not bad. It's like, it's kind of like when you watch a horror movie where the family moves into the haunted house, and at first everybody's like, oh, look at this house. It's so beautiful. It's so big. Kids, what rooms do you want? The kids are fighting for the rooms until the son or the disturbed daughter goes into the closet and she finds, like, broken dolls and shattered pictures of creepy-looking unibrow children and
kind of
stuff
sounds
like
you're describing the not The Conjuring, but Insidious 2.
It could be. It was
The Conjuring.
Yeah, it was The Conjuring.
The Conjuring, where they go in the little secret passageways and then they find all the knickknacks in the hall behind the room and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, good deal.
Yeah, but this was more frightening.
Outstanding.
I couldn't pee, man. I mean, try holding your junk and trying to pee while you're looking at death. It's crazy. I felt like an 80-year-old.
You would think that would make it easier, because most when people die, it's not pretty. It's not like in the movies. People relieve themselves. Their muscles relax. Bowels are emptied. So you would think it would make it easier to pee.
What does death and Chipotle have in common?
I don't know.
They both make you shit your pants.
That's...
Was that funny? I don't think
sounds,
so.
Sounds... I don't know. I... Not liking Chipotle, like, at all, I'm sure that's probably a good joke.
How was your week?
The only really cool, interesting... we have our most dedicated of listeners. His name is Jeremy. And he has often sent us interesting news articles, and he has even suggested a movie from time to time. And we actually used to do a podcast together called The Wow Factor Show. And he has decided to resurrect this World of Warcraft podcast. And he found a buddy of his actually in Canada. So they're further apart than we are, because Jeremy's in Florida. And his co-host, his name is Cody, is in Canada. So that's got to be fun for them. And they are bringing the show back, and they've actually got a pretty funny little promo up on their website, and I promised I would plug him because he's my friend and he's helped us and supported us. And you can go to wowfactorshow.podbean.com and you can go check that out. And best of luck to him. I hope it is very successful. And if I ever play WoW again, I'd be happy to go on there and talk about WoW again, but I don't think that's happening.
If there is a WoW movie, would we be able to go on their show and talk about the WoW movie? Like a
actually, that
episodes?
Would be an excellent crossover. That would be a most excellent crossover, because not only could we go on their show to discuss the movie of WoW, they, as WoW players, can come to our show and then talk about the differences in the game, the lore of the game, versus what we see from the movie. So it'll be just like in the olden days when they would do backdoor pilots and stuff, and you'd get the cast from Family Matters on Step by Step.
TGIF, motherfuckers. Or then you have those that leave the show and spawn their other shows, like Mork from Happy Days, or maybe are you their Mork from Happy Days? Because you left the show and went on to have another show. Or their Joni Loves Chachi.
To be honest, I'm not really sure whether or not I am an official Joni Loves Chachi spinoff or not, because I don't know that when we initially had started doing the podcast oh so long ago, if the Wow Factor show was on hiatus or not. If it was on hiatus, then I guess technically not. But if it wasn't, if it hadn't gone on official hiatus yet, then that would definitely be the case. Hopefully, we'll get an opportunity to talk to Jeremy at some point and ask him. So that would be kind of fun. Are you ready to go in straight into it?
Let's do it.
All right, then. It is time for...
The
Yes, the news. News, news, news. All right, I have a few items, and I think I went first last week, so I'm going to go ahead, and since I've been talking for a little bit anyway, relax, sit back, and enjoy the world of news as told by Mr. Hollywood Cronkite himself, Tim Kuzniar. Go ahead,
Hollywood
sir.
Cronkite? That's a good nickname. Right? I like that.
Thank you.
Or if I was more hip, it would be Hollywood Crunkite. Or Crunk.
Don't ruin it. Don't ruin it. We had a good thing.
Well, you sit back and lubricate your cockles, and I shall...
I'm going to lubricate my Lilo thingy-ma-doo-hicker, right? Is that what it was?
Oh, Lilo. You know, I got to take a picture of it, but during our walks around town that we go on, not Matt and I, but Chelsea and I, we walk by this
I'm there
building.
In spirit.
You're definitely here in there in spirit whenever I walk by this sign. And right across the street from this building, there's the Studs Movie Theater, and that place was known for showing Deep Throat back in the 70s. Now it's a gay porno theater. Well, right across the street, there is a... It's too big to be a store. It looks more like a lab. It's more of like the laboratory / Apple iPod store, or the Apple store of... vibrators and anal tickler accessories. And one of their big signs says the Lilo 894.5 FG. And it's like, these things must be so popular that they have so many models out that they have to add on, like, iPhone 5S or the Galaxy GS or G, whatever. They do that to vibrators as well, and it's very weird. So I've walked by it, and I look at it, and I'm like, Matt.
The question I have, though, is that whenever they're released, do people line up around the block to get in line to get one of these things? To shove up their ass or whatever?
Who knows, maybe. I mean, there are a lot more people that are more open about what they put in their selective crotchular region holes, I guess.
Wait a minute. Did you just... what was there? A selective crotchular... I'm pretty sure that everybody only... Well, for the most part, I'm sure there are medical marvels out there that I don't want to know about. There's pretty much only two holes for everybody, right? I mean, well, I guess technically women would have three, but
right.
I mean, I don't know how selective you'd have to be. I don't know. I don't, you know what? Let's just stop this now. Do the news, buddy. You're up. Go ahead.
Michael Fassbender apparently is refusing to campaign for his upcoming movie, 12 Years a Slave, where he's playing a vicious slave owner. And I got to say that this is definitely one of the three or four movies that are coming out during the remainder of 2013 that I'm really, actually really looking forward to. And this is what he says. This is from an article called Oscars, Why Michael Fassbender's Refusal to Campaign Likely Won't Matter by Pete Hammond. And he quotes the issue of GQ where they're interviewing Michael Fassbender, and Michael Fassbender says that, quote, "I'm going to be busy working. I just don't really have time. Campaigning is just not going to happen because I'll be in New Zealand. I'll be on the other side of the world. You know, I get it. Everybody's got to do their job. So you try to help and facilitate as best as you can. But I won't put myself through the kind of situation again. It's just a grind. And I'm not a politician. I'm an actor," Fassbender said of the whole Oscar process, which seems to grow every year and includes numerous Q&As, luncheons, meet and greets, private screenings, film festival tributes, presenting at endless award shows, well-timed talk show appearances, etc., and etc. Many artists who suddenly find themselves the object of an all-out Oscar campaign find this part of the job even more grueling than making the actual film. And by the time the Oscars roll around, they are spent. Pete Hammond goes on to say that, campaign or no campaign, in Fassbender's case, it may not matter. He's very likely going to get nominated and could win for Best Supporting Actor. And I think that's a scenario whether he lifts a finger or not in doing the usual rounds. The film and the role are so strong it's hard to imagine the actor's branch ignoring him. Now after the nominations it could change, especially in a tight, competitive race where every vote counts. So, and I agree with him, I think no matter how much you campaign or you don't campaign, if you have a standout performance, I don't know, I'm hoping that those people will be recognized. Because I agree with them. What's the point of enjoying your life as an actor if you go through a process where you absolutely hate it? Next up is an article from Deadline.com by Mike Fleming Jr. And the article is entitled, Napoleon Dynamite Producer Sets Movie About the Kids Who Made Shot-by-Shot Raiders of the Lost Ark Remake. And this is something that I've never heard of. And apparently back in the 80s, starting in... I think it was 1982 until 1979, the same group of kids spent every summer and spent a lot of money. I believe it was, I think maybe $5,000 of their own money or whatever money they can raise. And they reproduced Raiders of the Lost Ark, like the title says, a shot-by-shot remake. They psychoed it, kind of like how they did Psycho in the late 90s, just shot-by-shot remake. But what makes this kind of charming is that this is done... not only in the 80s, where stuff was limited production-wise, technically limited, but it was done by young kids. These kids just capture, is the very essence of the imagination of a young child. And especially like when, I mean, I'm sure it might have been the same thing with you, Matt, like being a kid, growing up watching Star Wars, watching Indiana Jones, a number of movies, and going outside and pretending that you were them, and playing around, pretending that you're running away from that big boulder that he does in Raiders. But these guys take it a step further, and they actually go and reproduce the movie. And this article says, again by Mike Fleming Jr., says, quote, Napoleon Dynamite producer Jeremy Kuhn has optioned Raiders, the Alan Einstock book that tells how two Mississippi kids set out to remake Raiders of the Lost Ark. The PAL started at 11 and finished when they turned 18, and in that time managed to restage every scene, shot, and stunt in their backyards and basements. They first shot on Betamax and then on VHS when the former became obsolete. The kid filmmakers Chris Stambolos and Eric Zala met in elementary school and are now in their early 40s. They will produce the Kuhn 2 projects, and their life rights are part of the package. First, Kuhn intends to direct a documentary as he works to set up a narrative feature, which is essentially a movie about the making of a movie that is a remake of another movie. When Kuhn first saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, the adaptation, at a film festival, it was during a period when all the optimism and wide-eyed wonder that went into making The Gem, Napoleon Dynamite, had been replaced by depression and cynicism. Kuhn and his cohorts were forced to sue Fox after feeling shortchanged by the proceeds of their $400,000 budget film that grossed nearly $50 million worldwide and made a lot more than that on video, and the suit is still going on. And Kuhn says that, quote, "I thought the movie was an urban myth, but when I saw it from a filmmaker perspective, it was more inspiring than any movie I'd ever seen. These kids had done something ridiculous and impossible, and the last time I had that experience of a movie being made because it was sheer fun was when I'd seen Kill Bill. I went in feeling cynical, but there was no cynicism in these kids. They did the movie because they loved it. It had its premiere and then sat on the shelf." Steven Spielberg has even seen this, and he wrote these guys a letter, and I believe they even met him. Now they're adults now. They've met Steven Spielberg, and he's congratulated him. He said that they did a great job, and that he was both amazed and impressed. What's good is that you can see the future of filmmaking in these guys. Within your generation, within our generation, there is the sign of hope in the effect of good movie making, and about the fun, and about the entertainment, and about the good story, and the adventure. So I'm really hoping that this becomes like a popular trend passing down throughout the generations. Real quick, he also says that they shot the Nepal bar scene in Eric's basement and lit the whole thing on fire. His mom saw what they had done, and she was not having any more of that. They had to get an adult, an extra in the original George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, who was less responsible than they were. The scene that got me most, Kuhn says, was one of the kids learned everything about special effects and did a mold face on Eric so they could recreate Belloc's face as it melts after he opens the ark. They did it with plaster. They put the ball in Eric's mouth so he would appear to be screaming. 5 minutes in, Eric starts sweating and he can't hear or speak. They use construction plaster, which gets hot when it hardens, and they couldn't break the mold. His mother comes down to see them trying to cut through it with a hacksaw. The hospital finally got it off with a cast saw, carefully working around his head with a little circular saw to free him. The plaster ripped out the eyebrows and every eyelash on the poor kid. He had a pencil on some eyebrows to go back to school. Some of it is just charming. If you took the first 20 minutes of the movie Super 8 and played it as a comedy, that's how I see this, Kuhn said. So that's something to look forward to. Hopefully it gets made.
Well, you mentioned that this movie has been seen by Spielberg and stuff like that. Is it that hard to find?
You might be able to find it online.
Like get on YouTube or something like that?
I don't know. Possibly. I haven't tried yet.
I'd like to see it. I mean, I know I would like to see it. Because as you mentioned, yes, I definitely played Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark stuff and Star Wars and everything. I played all that kind of fun stuff, G.I. Joe and Star Trek. And yeah, I never thought to myself to try and make a movie. We were kind of po-ass white folk. we would never have been able to get a hold of a movie camera, much less $5,000. But yeah, interesting stuff. I do hope that the movie gets made as well. Or at least that there's a reliable way to see this very dedicated remake.
It's just a very happy little story that caught me off guard. The movie The Fifth Estate, you know, that WikiLeaks movie about Julian Assange. Well, it's not a WikiLeaks movie, it's a movie about WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. It's a DreamWorks movie. DreamWorks. And Julian Assange has been trying hard to cast a negative light on this movie, or to cast a negative shadow, to cast negative whatever upon this movie. He even has gone as far, some time ago, months ago, to leak the script via WikiLeaks, to leak the Fifth Estate script via WikiLeaks. So, I mean, he's trying everything he can. There's only so much you can do with leaking a script. It's not gonna really do anything, but maybe what he did this time around might do something, might scratch the surface on trying to get people to not see it by attacking the main character that I'm sure a number of the people who will go and see this movie, not only because of the story, but because of the actor playing Julian Assange, and that would be Benjamin Cumberbatch, who is Sherlock in the series Sherlock. He was Khan in the recent Star Trek movie, and he will be Smaug, or Smaug, that's how Peter Jackson says it, in the upcoming Hobbit movie. And this is an article by Jen Yamato, and the article is entitled WikiLeaks Continues Anti-Fifth Estate Campaign Posts Assange Letter to Cumberbatch Online. And it says, quote, WikiLeaks and its embattled founder Julian Assange keeps trying to make it crystal clear that they don't support DreamWorks' upcoming film, The Fifth Estate. Today, WikiLeaks published the first of Assange's letters to Benjamin Cumberbatch, who plays him in the October 18 release, denying the actor's request to meet prior to production. The pic, directed by Bill Condon, is based on Inside WikiLeaks. Yeah, we know what it's about. And along with the post of the leaked script, there is also a memo attached to it as well, which details everything that the film gets wrong. And I'm not going to read it, but there's a very interesting letter that Julian Assange goes through, and he uses a lot of spaces in this letter. So it takes up like 3 pages, but really, if you put it all together and probably make some paragraphs out of it, it could easily be maybe a page, 12-point font, maybe. There are a lot of movies that were made, biopics made, that a lot of people really didn't agree with. Look at The Queen that Helen Mirren was in. She played Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth didn't care for it that much, but she didn't really come out and say anything. She didn't battle the movie. She didn't go against it. She didn't try to sue anybody. Instead, she saw the movie and invited Helen Mirren over to hang out, and probably to dame her, because she is actually really good in the movie. So if anything, Julian Assange is not keeping anybody from seeing this movie. He is drawing more attention to it. He is doing what Disney did not do for Escape from Tomorrow. He is creating more controversy, and not the bad controversy, he is creating the good controversy. He is catching the interest of those that probably didn't want to go see the movie firsthand because of who it was about. This might entice people to go see it, because he doesn't like it, and probably just to see what they got right. Alright, another article from thedissolve.com, and this one is, The State of Idaho Will Not Show Blue is the Warmest Color. This is the film that I was talking about that depicts lesbian love, as in how it happens in real life. The ups, the downs, the sexiness, the not-so-sexiness, true love, not-so-true love. But in addition to the controversy behind the camera, there is big controversy pertaining to the movie theaters that will not show the movie. And this is interesting because these are a lot of movie theaters that will probably end up showing 50 Shades of Grey, but they will not show what I hear is a really good movie. And the article says, quote, Boise, Idaho's four-screen theater, The Flicks, opened in September 1984, is the only art house in the state, but it won't be able to show the Palme d'Or-winning drama Blue is the Warmest Color without legal trouble. In Idaho, the ability to hold a liquor license is tied directly to Idaho Code 23-614, which defines acts of indecency and obscenity that can't be shown in such locations as acts of simulated acts of sexual intercourse, masturbation, sodomy, bestiality, oral copulation, and flagellation. Plus, any person being touched, caressed, or fondled on the breast, buttocks, anus, or genitals, or they could be genitals, but genitals. Blue contains most of the above, hence can't be shown at The Flicks. It isn't because we're prudes, theater owner Carol Skinner told The Hollywood Reporter. Apparently the theater also went through the same controversy a couple years ago when it wasn't able to show the drama Shame, the sex addict drama Shame. Boise Weekly writer George Prentice wondered whether the terms of the Idaho Code would also apply to a lot of R-rated movies. And it turns out, actually, yes, that a lot of R-rated movies would be in violation. That penal code is screwing itself in the Gentiles, I think. Indian actor Kumar Pulana, born 1918, passed away 2013. He was a veteran of Wes Anderson films. You guys have seen The Terminal. He was the janitor, the likable janitor who does all the carnival sideshow tricks. He passed away. He was in The Darjeeling Limited, Romance and Cigarettes, 10 Items or Less, Bottle Rocket. Very talented guy, always played some pretty sweet roles, very likable. Just gotta check out, whenever you watch some of these movies and pay more attention to him, because he's just a cool guy, and he just always seemed cool, especially watching interviews, seemed nice, seemed thankful for what he has within the movie community and within being in film, and being in such prestigious films as well, working with such great filmmakers. So again, that's Kumar Palana, passed away, born 1918, and just passed away this month. And that's all I got.
Okay, excellent news segment. All right, so I've got just a few pieces of news here. First up is kind of select snippets from FilmSchoolRejects.com, courtesy of Rob Hunter. This comes from a list of 23 things we learned from Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing commentary. All right, basically, Joss Whedon and his friends decided to make Much Ado About Nothing in his house. And there are people who are saying it's Joss Whedon's finest work. This movie is shot entirely in black and white. And they decided to, of course, do a commentary track and just get some interesting factoids from it. And I thought that this was pretty cool here. That the coolest thing that they found out here is that while they were filming the initial wedding scene, they were interrupted by police responding to complaints from Whedon's neighbors about the parking situation out front. The cops turn around and tell them that they have to have a permit to film and would have to stop. And Whedon says that they acknowledged that they had grown lax regarding the parking, but he felt they didn't need a permit for filming on his own property. And as soon as the cops left, they just went ahead and kept on filming. Another pretty interesting thing here is the drinking. Yes, the drinking is something that is noted. And they said that, noting that how much of the cast is drinking constantly throughout the film, and that half the fun was deciding what exactly they should be drinking. For the villains, it was decided that they should be drinking something exotic, and then, quote, ooh, we have a sake set, end quote. Another interesting little thing here was that because it's in black and white, he says that he seldom regretted shooting the film in black and white, but one of the times he did is the scene where Benedict and Claudio enter their guest room. It's Whedon's daughter's room, and the walls are bright pink. They considered making certain scenes and or items in color, but they eventually decided it was too complicated and expensive. And the list goes on and on. This is just a fun list of things here. Probably one of the coolest things I think that they did was they talk about challenges here, and one of the challenges he embraced during the production was, quote, making a film that has the energy of a play and the language of a film, end quote. He wanted to maintain the fun atmosphere from his home readings while pairing it with the aesthetic of a film. Part of that was placing the opening credits over the opening throwaway scene to give viewers time to ease into the language before the real story starts. And it's just more of that kind of fun stuff. So if you have seen this movie, or you're just a Whedon file, as it goes, you'd definitely head on over to Film School Rejects and check that out. Next up, coming to us from IndieWire.com, courtesy of Clint Holloway. Madonna banned from Alamo Drafthouse after texting during 12 Years as a Slave premiere. This was the New York Film Festival premiere of 12 Years as a Slave.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And basically, this is what's up here. The news originated from a Facebook post by film critic Charles Taylor, who passed along the following anecdote from a former student. And here is the blurb. Tonight at the New York Film Festival premiere of 12 Years a Slave, a masterpiece, by the way, I sat behind the unholy trifecta of Jason Ritter, Jay Alexander from America's Next Top Model, and Michael K. Williams from The Wire. Plus, a mysterious blonde in black lace gloves who wouldn't stop texting on her BlackBerry throughout the first half of the movie. Eventually, a woman next to me tapped her on the shoulder and told her to put her phone away. And the blonde hissed back, "It's for business, enslaver!" I turned to the shoulder tapper and loudly said, "Thanks," and gave her a thumbs up. The rest of the movie, I kept thinking about how I wanted to tell the blonde what a disgrace she was. During the standing ovation, the blonde ducked out, and Jason Ritter turned around to make commiserating eye contact. As Jay Alexander asked, "Who was that?" Jason then looked down at the floor. His eyes got wide, and he picked up an envelope and showed it to us and Jay. And it said, "Two screening ticks, Madonna." And sure enough, we looked to the side of the theater, and standing against the wall in black lace gloves was Madonna, the worst person in America. So because God. Of this...
And she was using a BlackBerry? Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The least of the problems was her texting in an Alamo Drafthouse. It was because she was using a BlackBerry. When Alamo Drafthouse got wind of this, they did ban her. So I think they are going to... Here it goes. Upon hearing of Madonna's violation, they took to Twitter barring her from stepping foot inside any of the Drafthouse cinema locations until she issues an apology to moviegoers. Madonna has yet to respond, perhaps because she has too many business-related texts to catch up on. Finally, yeah. Variety.com, courtesy of Justin Kroll, film reporter. It's important to stress it like that because of the title here. Marvel likes Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Paul Rudd for Ant-Man, exclusive. Yes, sequels to Thor and the Avengers may be on the horizon at Marvel, but the company's antennas are increasingly tuned to Edgar Wright's Ant-Man. Sources tell Variety that the two actors who have emerged as frontrunners to land the title role in the superhero feature are Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Paul Rudd. Insiders warn, or Paul Rudd, you know who I'm talking about. Insiders warn that there's still a remote possibility another actor could emerge, but as of now, Gordon-Levitt and Rudd are the main contenders for the film. Marvel recently moved up the release date of the comic book feature to July 31st, 2015, and Wright, following his vacation, tweeted a pre-production photo of the Ant-Man character, which has since reignited the anticipation that an actor would be attached shortly. Basically, sources indicate the two are expected to meet with Marvel execs and write one more time before a decision is made, and that there's also a possibility of another actor entering the mix. What do you think? Either one of these people? Neither one of these people?
I really, really, really like Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I just really don't see how Paul... I don't know.
That's where, of course we talk about stuff before we record, folks. That's part of putting on a halfway not retarded show. My thinking on this is pretty much what I said in the pre-show stuff, was that I prefer Joseph Gordon-Levitt over Paul Rudd, but if they're kind of going with a smart alecky feel to the character, Paul Rudd's going to have that in spades over Joseph Gordon-Levitt. The problem is if they go that route, can he be taken seriously? Or is it going to be like another Green Lantern debacle?
Or the Green Hornet.
Or Green Hornet, even.
Very interesting choices there, because I don't know.
Okay, well, only time will tell, and that's all right. Okay, then I guess that concludes the news, and brings us to... Masterpiece Discussion with Matt and Tim. Today's discussion will be the state of horror. We will start with Tim and a history of horror according to Tim. Tim, please enlighten us.
Yes. So today, we'll be talking about the current state of horror movies, and whether horror movies evolved into something good, or possibly something bad, over the years. So I'm going to kick this discussion off with a bit of input into the history of horror movies. Now, beforehand, I just want to say that I grew up loving movies of all genres. There was one genre in particular that I actively kept some distance away from, and that was the horror genre, because that shit just scared the crap out of me during the 80s and early 90s. Now, I grew up watching the early classics, the Frankensteins, the Draculas, the Mummies, The Thing. I loved John Carpenter's The Thing from the 80s. I loved Ridley Scott's Alien, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, It... I think It was a TV movie that freaked me out as a kid. Unsolved
Dude,
Mysteries.
It was the best, man. And oh my God, I had like nightmares going to sleep with Robert Stack going, on the next episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd be like, no!
And it was like the most twisted stuff. And I think what gets me about Unsolved Mysteries was that every ending wasn't necessarily happy. Like there was some really twisted... effed up aspect to like that person's life that they will have to live with until the day they die. And as a kid, that put a bad taste in my mouth. And as I got older, I began venturing off into various subgenres and exploring the nightmare movies, the Halloween movies, the Jason Voorhees movies, and the Freddy Krueger movies. And it was all these kind of movies that helped expand my imagination, and it became a part of the building blocks of my dreams and aspirations of working in the film industry. with watching and studying these movies, I like to think, and Matt, I'm sure you agree with me on this one, that I like to think that we're capable of expressing our opinions and being able to judge these certain flicks within the conversation in an educational and fair manner. So just to put it out there that we like to think we know our stuff.
I would agree with that, yes.
So in some way, we have a section of our hearts are dedicated to really good horror movies and what makes a good horror movie. And with saying that, I feel that the genre is quite different today than it was 70 years ago. It has evolved into something that seems to be more for the worse than the better. And this is kind of my reasoning why, and this is the history of the horror genre right here. Starting off in the 40s and 50s, this is surpassing the silent film era that began in the late 1800s. You have Buñuel, you have The Hunchback of Notre Dame. That was actually considered one of the first monster movies with the use of excellent settings and camera work and cinematography. And it was a good, not necessarily a creature feature, but it was frightening because of how they made The Hunchback out to be. You have Lon Chaney in Phantom of the Opera. At that time, you also have Nosferatu, which is a movie we talked about here, I think, last week. During the 1800s, they started dabbling in, even in silent films, started dabbling in monsters and figuring out ways of freaking out an audience. However, what's very interesting about movies from that time is that a lot of them were based off books. There wasn't really that, well, I mean, they still had original screenplays, but a lot of stuff was either based on history or based on books. And then in the 1930s, we start seeing the classic horror icons, the Draculas, the mummies, I believe the Wolfman from the 30s as well. Classic Frankensteins, we were talking about Freaks as well, so Freaks came out around that time. So the idea of horror started evolving to more of a fantastical, to more of an entertaining aspect, but at the same time, they were using what was the modern science that was going on, the revolutionary science, to create horror movies. Because if you think about it, a lot of movies from back then, in order to freak people out, some of them use science, technical breakthroughs, a man that can turn invisible. Why? Because of science. From the 1940s into the 1950s, the tone of horror films changed. They went from the gothic, which a lot of the Frankensteins, Draculas, that's the gothic, the gaudy-looking horror movies, the gaudy in tone, the gothic into the more contemporary. You start seeing a lot of subgenres, or the beginning of more subgenres. For example, you got the subgenres of Horror of the Armageddon and the Horror of Demonic. The Horror of the Armageddon, that's the alien invasion movies. Horror of the Demonic is the movies pertaining to mutations, like The Blob, Attack of the Giant Gila Monster, and crazy weird stuff like that. Every animal and every insect was huge at one point during the 1940s and 1950s, and I mean literally huge. Godzilla also, it's another one. Horror movies used to reflect the time that they were made, like I said, Frankenstein the Invisible Man, because of the achievements within the scientific community. People were awe-inspired by the discoveries in the future of science. And also, the Cold War-era McCarthyism inspired the story of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Thing from the Other World. Many movies were also politically charged. Take World War II, for example. World War II established a greater terror in the world that's a lot more sinister than Frankenstein and Count Dracula. This is when you start to see a huge shift in the genre. There's an Invisible Man movie where he goes off to fight the Germans. That is right. There is an Invisible Man where you see him flying not flying a bomber to go fight the Nazis. And during the 40s and 50s, you also saw the start of the doomed theater gimmicks. For example, 3D and the movie The Tingler, they had devices, the studios had theaters put devices into the theater seats that would tickle the audience during the scary parts. But that stuff didn't last too long. I mean, 3D kind of carried on until it kind of made a resurgence in the 70s, and then it's definitely back now because I guess technology and all that stuff is propelling it more into the forefront. Now, in the 50s to the 60s, you start seeing the emergence of foreign and indie horror flicks. For example, Roger Corman, who is known for making cheap movies in a short period of time. Mario Bava, the Italian filmmaker that we're actually be talking about later on, about his film Black Sabbath. He came out with an epitomal black and white horror movie called Black Sunday. You have George Romero, who started out in the 60s. He redefined horror with Night of the Living Dead. The French, the French New Wave of cinema, and at that time they were a part of the French New Wave of horror cinema even. The Brits were producing new Dracula and Frankenstein movies, taking cues from the gothic classic horror movies of the 1930s and early 1940s, and all those evolved from the classics. British director Michael Powell is credited with making the first slasher movie at this time, called Peeping Tom. And also in the 60s, you have Hitchcock. He made Psycho and The Birds. Those were more of mainstream horror hits. And throughout the 1960s, low-budget gore shock movies were becoming more and more popular. In the 1970s, the genre adopted sexual overtones and themes along to coincide with this gore. The 70s was influenced by the 60s due to the counterculture movement. Wes Craven's Hills Have Eyes, Last House on the Left, Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre was kind of a take on the Vietnam War. You have David Cronenberg, he made Shivers. Again, George Romero, he continued the series of zombie flicks with Dawn of the Dead, which satirized the consumer society. There's also the comedy horror movies that started out in the 70s. Rocky Horror Picture Show, Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein. And like the horror movies from the silent era, more horror movies were being based on books. Stephen King, Carrie, Shining. Big studios started making what should be B-grade movies by using traditional B-grade movie elements. Steven Spielberg's Jaws was a low-budget flick that was a huge box office success. Only B-movies at that time ever thought about making a movie about a killer shark in the waters. You also have Alien. At that time, Alien was referred to as Jaws in Space. Alien incorporated science fiction into horror. Also, it could be looked as a throwback to the early monster movies. And then from the 70s into the 1980s, we saw the use of major special effects. Again, Alien, The Thing, Poltergeist, and beginnings of a cycle of slasher flicks from John Carpenter's Halloween. In the 1980s, the continuation of the iconic slasher films and successful and unsuccessful independent gory flicks, which often became cult classics. A number of them would even spawn years of sequels and remakes 20-some-odd years later. Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, Evil Dead, you have the teen vampire movies, Lost Boys, Fright Night. 1990s to the present. Innovative technology becomes a major selling point in movies. Top of my head, I mean, I can't really think of many 90s horror movie classics other than Scream. Which, I mean, and everything else just basically rehashes basic scenarios and plot outlines from previous horror movies. And then you have the 2000s to now, which during this time, one could say that not a lot of progression has been made. There's been an overabundance of found footage movies, remakes, and sequels. I mean, I like the movie, the remake of Last House on the Left and Evil Dead, but I didn't like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies or the Jason remakes, the Halloween remakes, or the Nightmare on Elm Street remakes. You know, and so that kind of brings us to, what kind of spawned the torture porn. Not necessarily spawned the torture porn, because that stuff's been around since the 70s, but like the Saw movies, where it was more the shock factor, and how much blood and guts can we use in a scene to freak out movie to where it's not necessarily terror, it's just, you know, like I said, shock factor. And it's just blood on the screen everywhere. Franchises are big now. You look at Saw movies, you look at the Final Destination movies. So this is where we're at. Franchises. Or has horror cinema taken a turn with The Conjuring and Insidious to where now we are starting to develop new ideas?
Where I pretty much land on it is where you started. Not even that it's different, okay? I don't find that horror is different because all things evolve. So virtually everything is different today than it was back then. There are very few just cut and dry things. I would probably say the only exception to that would more than likely be the romantic comedy. That's pretty much still formulaic, with terrible exceptions of, you know, Friends with Benefits or whatever the fuck that was. Horror movies, though, I think when it comes to today's horror industry, what we have is... So I don't want to keep throwing the same old tired excuse out there, but we do have an antiquated system that refuses to change with the times. And one of the problems with that is that they only chase known money. And it's something that more or less came about with the Friday the 13th. And this is my opinion here, that came about with the Friday the 13th syndrome and the Nightmare on Elm Street syndrome and the Halloween syndrome, where they pretty much just thought that they had something bankable, and so they just kept making it and making it and making it, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse, and they just kept making it anyway because they knew people would come in and would buy tickets for it. And it forced real horror into, where Tim kind of refers to subgenres and stuff, it really forced good horror further into those trenches. And so where you only get the occasional glimpses of good horror from movies, even in that time period, from movies like Evil Dead, nothing there is what the studio system considers to be commercially viable. So then they don't make it, and they don't pursue it, and they don't. And then everybody's just magically blown away when you get a movie like The Blair Witch Project, you know, that was essentially student made for like $30,000 or something, or you get a Paranormal Activity, which is, you know, just a few years ago, and that was made for like $15,000 or something stupid like that, and then turns around and makes $100 million or whatever, or hundreds of millions of dollars. Even now with like today, with The Conjuring and stuff like that, with these minuscule budgets by Hollywood standards, you know, just a couple million dollars or so, and then they turn around and they make $30, $40, $50 million. And yet, after all this time, the studio system still doesn't catch on. And what's the first thing they do? They just go and try and make the same fucking movie again. And they just throw a ton more money at it, and then they turn it into something tired. And we kind of saw that with Insidious: The Second Chapter, where they did the right thing by trying to truly continue the story. They took a chance where the viewer knows what's going on and kind of has to experience what the people are going through as they go through it. But then when you get to the end again, and you can already see, oh man, they're starting to go down that path again. And it starts to hurt the quality. It's like they just don't want anything that could potentially be a one-off. They only want something they can turn into a money fest. The thing is that that's kind of missing the point. You can ultimately make more money in a lot of different ways and a lot more creatively by allowing one-offs to happen. Because then people will continually go and take chances and spend more money on one-offs, and you don't have to continually raise production costs because people are coming back for sequels, and those things cost more money, and everybody's like, oh, it's an established franchise, so now everybody wants to make more money, and then they have to start spending more and more and more to recoup everything. Makes it a whole lot easier if you would just do it right in the first place. And so here we have today, the horror movie, it's not different, in my opinion, it's not different, it's just worse, it's bad. And we're kind of in this in-between area now. And the Huffington Post did a pretty good one earlier this year, back in July, from their entertainment section. And there was an interview that they did, Mike Ryan from the Huffington Post did an interview with Adam Wingard on the state of horror movies. And this is a gentleman who directed Your Next, which was, by all accounts, a pretty darn good horror flick. But more importantly, this is the guy who we will be talking about later directed one of the best mini sections from the horror anthology movie VHS 2. Even he starts off, even from the very first few questions of this article. The first question is talking about how the movie's really fun and whatever, but the second question is, where is mainstream horror right now? Because I can't figure it out. And it comes back, quote, I don't think it's anywhere. I think that we're in a weird in-between phase of what's the next wave of horror. And I don't think we know what it is. Hopefully, it will be more of things like The Conjuring, end quote. That's what we're talking about. You see all these interesting movies coming out, and yet you're never going to see them in a really good light because very rarely will a studio take a chance on it. And I think that's really the downside here. We have to kind of find this vibe, not so much necessarily with what Saw did per se for the 2000s, although that definitely helped to a certain degree, but we need to be able to find a more vibrant selection. And I think that's where you get stuff like that's currently going on in LA right now. And you can check out your LA Times for this kind of stuff. Mark Olson initially wrote about this back on the 27th of September, but it's still ongoing now, which is the Beyond Fest. And it goes from October 10th, so it only started a week ago, and it goes through the 27th. They have all sorts of cool stuff. They also, every day for the month of October, the Fairfax Avenue Movie Theater, CineFamily, they are
It's just right showing, down the street.
Yeah. They are showing every night. They're taking a trip around the United States, and it's called the United States of Horror Program. And every night at midnight, they feature a movie from a different state of the union. They started off with California's Equinox. They go to Arizona for Wide of the Eye, Nevada's Tremors, Utah's Troll 2, Kansas for Carnival of Souls, Missouri, Ernest Scared Stupid. And again, it's running the gamut from family-style horror movie to stupid, terrible movies that are just B-movies and bad to interesting kind of flicks to stuff that you've never heard of. And this is the kind of stuff that will always do well. I just really am sad that you can go from such a really neat exploration of things from your youth and looking back on horror and also looking at what drove horror, even as Tim had stated with, you know, when people were looking at something as political satire or when they were trying to make a point about something and just using horror to tell the story. Horror is a wonderful thing to be an analogous for anything that you want, even like with today with The Walking Dead. It's not just about zombies. What makes it so compelling to a certain degree, when they're not just bickering and doing stupid shit, what makes it so compelling is that you are forced to see what life is like on a subsistence level and how it drives relationships.
Yeah, people need that connection with the movie in some way.
Right, and that's horror. And people are like, but horror is supposed to be slasher and boobies. And that's the problem. We have to be able to open it up. Just as there are tons of different kinds of thrillers, and all of those kinds of thrillers make it to the screen, and then you have tons of different kind of action movies, and all those action movies make it to the screen. And you have tons of different kinds of comedies, and all those kinds of comedies make it to the screen. You only get one brand of horror in the mainstream. And that, for me, is the biggest problem. We just have to find a way to fix that. There is actually, and this is sadly, this is an article that's 3 years old. Comes to us from ScreenRant.com, courtesy of Christian Toto. And even then, I'll go into the details, but basically, there are 5 ways to save horror movies. There's the top 5 ways to save horror movies. So we'll recap with that. But these are the kinds of things that I'm talking about. It's, for me, horror can be saved, but horror is not in a good state right now.
My big thing is that I think what's wrong is pretty much what Matt said, but to kind of elaborate more, what used to be made of rich films, the horror genre, that is, are now becoming a bunch of remake sequels and recycled material that have no substance or backing to it. And, you know, like what he was talking about, you need something to connect with the audience. With The Thing from the Other World, with the political satire movies, the audience had a connection. They could relate in some way. They had something to be scared of. In the 80s, again, you saw another reemergence with, well, in the 70s, 60s, 70s, you had the counterculture. In the 80s, you had, I really don't know what to call what really came after the counterculture, but the stuff that, the reason why people really connected to the post-apocalyptic movies, because I think a lot, oh, the Cold War. Yeah, because people were freaked out about the Cold War, you know, still going on. Nations were still in quite a deadlock when it came to pushing the nuclear button. And it seems to me that a lot of the popular stuff, and if it's not the Paranormal Activity movies, it seems like people make horror movies just based off exploiting a subgenre. You have the torture porn, you have the slasher movies, the found footage movies. Just these studios are just exploiting it, like what Matt said, just whatever is popular, whatever is successful. And thankfully, we do have indie movies like VHS and VHS 2. They might not be the best anthologies, but they encompass, they have like this particular spark to it that all these other movies don't have, that in some way, they're still, well, at least to me, they're still enjoyable to watch. Also, a number of modern horror flicks turn to the basics, the classics, because of the creativity and the pacing. There are a few modern-day horror movies that attempt such pacing and actually succeed. I mean, you have The Conjuring and Insidious. Those movies, for the most part, were successful. But films like Paranormal Activity fail miserably in quality by becoming more boring and repetitive than scary or engaging. From Grantland.com, an article by Zach Brown, he says that, quote, "Horror movies are manipulative and coercive in a way other kinds of movies aren't. If a person is walking alone in a completely silent house, and all of a sudden there is an insanely loud noise, I will jump, because thousands of years of human evolution have conditioned me to jump. But I feel pretty much whatever these sick, sadistic horror directors want me to feel when I'm watching Saw. But it's amazing how much time all four of the Paranormal Activity movies devotes to people simply walking up and down stairs and crying out, "Who's there?" And to go in more detail about the state of movies like Paranormal Activity movies and how pretty much a one-trick pony. And he continues in his article saying that the Paranormal Activity franchise began as a viral word-of-mouth success. The first Paranormal Activity movie is sometimes called the most profitable film of all time because its initial $65.1 million gross on a movie that cost $15,000 to make yielded like a 433,900% return on investment. So because of that, Paramount and DreamWorks bought the film for cheap. And Paramount's original plan for the movie, when they acquired the first Paranormal Activity, was to reshoot the film with real actors and lighting and production values, and you can see why. It looks terrible, even by grainy found footage standards. As the franchise goes on, everyone gets better looking. Some of the mythology starts to get filled in, which to me, Tim, this is me talking now, which to me ruins whatever spark this series has, by making the movie look better and making everything look prettier and polished. However, another writer by the name of Evan Sathoff from BladeDiscussing.com absolutely loves the current state of horror. And this is kind of going off of what Matt was saying, that a lot of people just look at horror as movies about tits and ass and blood and gore. And this is one of those guys that thinks that, and this is what he is saying by representing BladeDiscussing.com. Why he thinks horror is better now than when he was a kid in the late 80s. He says it's because of TV. Just to go through key points on here. He had a serious film itch when he was a child. He saw the Halloween 4 and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 movies by the method of going over to his friend's house and watching it because his parents wouldn't allow him to watch it. It's kind of like me. I watched, the freakiest Freddy movie, and I think that was Freddy Krueger 5, the last one that I think Wes Craven actually directed it, when it's based on actually like real life and Wes Craven's actually in it. Freaked me out, had to watch over at a friend's house. But he says that fortunately there was method two, other than going over to a friend's house and watching, that was television. Granted, this wasn't good for horror films, but it worked wonders for horror itself because mom couldn't monitor everything I watched. Both Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th had television shows. The USA Network had great up-all-night programming. We had The Hitcher, A New Twilight Zone. It seemed like a golden age of televised horror, but it wasn't. Compared to what you guys have today, the horror solace I found was like a G-rated examination of the powers of friendship, starring a bunch of big-eyed cartoon ponies. My point is, you really young horror fans need to take a moment to marvel at how good you have it. Today, if you're hungry for horror, you can turn on the television and watch The Walking Dead, a show that might suffer from 2 years of narrative stupidity, but it still represents a new high watermark for zombie makeup and gore. If you think your budding horror fandom might run a bit more kinky than that, current TV has you covered, as well thanks to the truly mental American Horror Story, which sometimes outshines pretty much any 1980s VHS treasure my mom tried to protect me from, as far as perversity goes. The show offers you a plastic mixture of Cronenberg and Verhoeven that has the potential to implant the more impressionable among you with really unique and interesting lifelong fetishes. End quote. And though I think he makes some interesting points, I do believe that his heart is in the wrong place. Horror is not about the sex, it's not about the gore, it's not about the boob count, as much as that could be very entertaining. It's about the story. Good stories are what we lack in today's cinema. Just, I mean, to be fair, it's not only within the gore genre. And it's because of that I find that the industry is the problem. You have the box office profit isn't necessarily the best way to evaluate the creative or progressive state of cinematic genre. Some of the most seminal horror movies were micro-budget, independent films, Halloween, Last House on the Left, and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. They were all made by nobodies at the time, and for a fraction of a typical Hollywood budget. Yet they are unarguably some of the most transcendental horror films ever produced. In the big picture, it's commonplace for amazing film to come along and introduce nuances to the horror genre every so many years. But that also leads to Hollywood getting a hold of the concepts and repeating it again and again. and again and again, along with pacing that movies are trying to go back to. Another movie, for example, that I think was successful for the most part, and I think, Matt, you're in this boat as well, is the remake of Evil Dead. Evil Dead, they got the gore with the substance right, but they were lacking the sense of maturity. There's one article, which I'll just tell you the who wrote it. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. It's an article from socialistworker.org by John McDonald. He is saying that, well, even though that Evil Dead, the remake, excels in the scares and the blood and the visual effects, there's a deeply unsatisfying element to this film that it took from its predecessor. The gore doesn't really mean anything, he was saying, in that it's the new version's deep appreciation for and the faithful reproduction of Evil Dead's immediate generic anecdotes that it's a chief weakness of. For example, how it there's this enthusiasm for violence, which can be fun, and that's why the movie succeeds, is because the movie is fun, and it's done in an entertaining way, and encompasses a good story. But there's people like this guy who says that, but still, nobody has matured, as in, like, how women are looked at. And I guess what he is saying is that those who are interested in the struggle for human liberation, sexism, will kind of have a problem with this movie. That he says the torture porny elements are failing, largely passed on from the original, though cast in sharper relief by the recent global resurgence of activism in response to rape and sexual assault. In some ways, the remake engages in meager attempts to improve upon the original's problems in this area. It says that it does include a departure from the 80s version that both challenges the prevailing moralism towards women's personal choices and makes at least one of the female characters into more than a passive vessel for demonic forces to possess and for the male characters to chop into pieces. So I guess that could still be a problem. But then again, I think that falls into the trope that a lot of these remakes and sequels and whatnot fall into.
I can understand the sentiment of the article with Evil Dead and stuff, but I still stand by my original reflections of that. And I think that in being faithful to the source material, they were not pigeonholing themselves on the points that were being made,
right,
but instead being true to the source material and letting the source material take them where it will. If those are still sticking points for certain people, then by God, that sounds like an excellent opportunity to make a new horror.
Right, and I think that's what they were saying, that they just want to see... I mean, though the movie was good, they're just worried that sexism will still be intact with even future horror movies.
Sure, and to that end, I mean, there's always movies like The Descent, which are strictly women in power roles, more or less. There's no sexism to be had. Unfortunately, it's not that great of a movie, but they're trying. There are examples of it, even with movies like I Spit on Your Grave, where the movie in and of itself may not necessarily be all that great or may only be known for shock value, but it is still women fighting against gender roles and gender assignments and not allowing a sexist action, especially in I Spit on Your Grave, to stand.
Right.
You know, the shit will not stand. We will prevail. So, outstanding. All right. Well, then, let me just go ahead and wrap this thing up with the article that I said I was going to be referring to here from Screen Rant. The first thing they said to do was avoid 3D horror movies. And they said that Piranha 3D was the only... was stands as an exception that proves the rule. But other than that... For example, like the old My Bloody Valentine remake, when the pickaxe popped off the screen, nobody was scared. I mean, come on. The second thing to do is just say no to mindless remakes. And they point out that there are occasionally good remakes, things like Let Me In, even when critics actually dug the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But those, again, are very far and few between, and you could argue, especially in the case of Let Me In, that that is not a mindless remake. Next up, follow the blogs, and this is where I actually found some really cool websites. BloodyDisgusting.com, DreadCentral.com, and HorrorMovies.ca. So even those Canadians, those really nice Canadians, they come out and they know their horror as well. And actually, it was kind of interesting because thanks to Bloody Disgusting, I've found out about a movie that I want to see now called Macabre, which looks way the hell creepy amazing, and looking forward to checking that one out as soon as possible. Number four, support the indies. And again, this is where you will see that people are always inspired, and that's where they get their development ideas for the next movies when you hear about all these movies that nobody's ever heard of. And that's, again, where the subgenres come in to become so important. Get in there and look at them. Movies that stand out from there are like Splinter, Rogue, House of the Devil, all quality shockers that got little or no theatrical love, according to the article. And then finally, tweet the best of the rest. That is to say, social media. Get into, find groups online that follow horror movies and get in and talk to them. Get with people on Twitter. Find Facebook groups and stuff like that. Maybe even go with like meetup.com where they have meetup groups and things like that. You can always search in your local area for just about anything and then find groups so that you can go and do like the stuff in LA that we were talking about earlier. Those are all really great things, and let's hope that we can see more Insidiouses and more Conjurings and less Freddy and Jason in the future. Thus concludes another episode of Discussions with Matt and Tim. Our next time discussing will be a surprise. We will let you know that next week after our 3 Squared, where Matt and Tim will discover and share their favorite horror franchises. And the 3, they can't pick them all. They have to have 3 of their best flicks from that one horror franchise. Until next time. Yeah, I've got nothing else. So should we just move on to the next segment then?
To the movies we shall venture off.
Let's go. All right.
The movies!
Yes, the movies. Okay, so we have a whole bunch of movies here we got to cover. We have the VHS movies, which are the found footage flicks. Then we've got the horror anthology movies that we were going to cover, which are Black Sabbath, Tales from the Hood, and Trick or Treat. Well, I guess we could speed that up and say Trick or Treat. Alrighty. Alright, so VHS 2012 anthology horror movies. If you're going to notice a pattern here, all the movies this week are anthologies. So that's where they have a whole bunch of vignettes. Sometimes they're boxed into a very clever narrative, and sometimes they're just put in a frame. This is VHS. The VHS series are one of them that is actually pretty cleverly done. They did try to have an overarching narrative. Works a little better in the next movie, but there's still a pretty solid one here. The idea here is that there's a group of guys who are hoodlums, and they like to videotape their exploits. They get essentially hired for a job where they have to break in and steal a specific VHS tape. They break in, they find a dude dead in front of a bank of televisions with white noise going on, and a whole mess of VHS tapes. So they are trying to get them all, so they make sure they get the right one. And then, of course, someone thinks it's a bright idea to start watching them. And thus, the movies begin. We have several different sections. There's the amateur night, second honeymoon, Tuesday the 17th. The sick thing that happened to Emily when she was younger. And then 10-31-98. The idea here is that they're trying to stress found footage. Think Blair Witch Project, if you're trying to think of an idea of found footage. It's not my favorite style, so I am a little bit predisposed to not liking it. That being said, these are overall really creative, small budget stuff. This film was made for less than $1 million. They are also backed by Bloody Disgusting, as I referred to earlier with BloodyDisgusting.com, and The Collective. They are very interestingly acted. I kind of like the idea behind the way that they pick the order of the movies and the flow of the films. I would have to say that the only one for me that kind of got to me, that I thought was kind of pretty kick-ass, was Second Honeymoon, which is where a married couple goes to, they go for their second honeymoon, and you get to see some pretty interesting shit moving on with a switchblade. Kind of a creepy way to build tension and stuff. It was very reminiscent of me for movies like Creepshow, and yet at the same time was this particular vignette was, I thought, fairly well acted. The other one that I thought was really kind of cool, at least in terms of execution and having a really interesting plot, was the sick thing that happened to Emily when she was younger, which is alien experimentation, more or less. But it's really kind of cool how they also framed this one. This was with a lot of video chat going on. So I liked the vignettes that tried to do something either really original or that were, for me, obvious throwbacks to stuff that had really been not done a whole lot. I walked away with this one giving it 3 stars. I did like it, but I definitely thought that there was room for improvement over this thing. But there and again, this is what you're looking for with small budget. These things are designed so that you can get really good ideas and kind of discover something new and hopefully turn it into something better.
I think the low budget really is what makes VHS. The camera work, I really like the camera work, and to me, it added a level of authenticity to it, especially with the first short, the second short, and I believe the last short as well. To me, it just worked great. Had a pretty good real-time momentum to it as well, and my god, to me, the creepiest one is the first one, which is about these guys. These guys are pretty much trying to get laid, and they want to do some chicks, but film it, and I guess put it online. And I think that's kind of like the backstory behind these guys. But the type of girl that they end up bringing back to their hotel turns out to be a girl that was probably better left drunken in a drunken stupor on the side of a street. Better for everybody. Just how I'm trying to talk about this movie without spoiling it, the setup of it and the pacing of it, to me, worked out wonderfully. I mean, to me, the pacing for the first one and the last one was great. I love the momentum of it. I like the things that happen, the events that happen throughout the short, and how, in order to create the effect in a low budget, not using computers, but in a very low budget, hands-on sort of way, they had to do everything again in real time and have to do stuff to keep the audience from seeing certain aspects of the production, the technical aspects of what was going on. However, I will say, and this also goes with the second one, but I guess we'll talk about that one in a bit, it falls into the forced anticipated horror, to where it's like, any sane person, if they have a chance to run to the door and get out of the door because they see that somebody is getting attacked by somebody, and more than likely that is their chance to leave. However, throughout these shorts, instead of people doing that, they run back and like hide in a closet or hide in a bathroom instead of just leaving and getting a head start while they can. However, that wouldn't make for a good horror story, so of course they run off and they do the stupid, illogical thing and go into the bathroom and hide, for example. So that's kind of where I am with my negative criticism with the movie. Overall, I think it's pretty good and pretty entertaining, and I think it's pretty innovative for not only the anthology genre, but also for the found footage genre as well. Because, yeah, you do get the shaky cam effect, but it's not nearly as bad as some of these other movies. It's done in good humor with pretty... Some of them have better acting than others. I mean, there's one in particular involving people going out camping where the acting is absolutely atrocious. And that's just a pretty bad short. So I gave this one 3.5 out of 5 stars. Again, these just really are kind of difficult ones to talk about without spoiling any specifics.
Then moving on to the very quickly produced, VHS had barely been out before they decided to go with VHS 2, 2013 anthology horror movie. The frame narrative on this one, though, is that you've got 2 private investigators looking for somebody, and they find, again, large stack of TV sets, VHS tapes, and then, of course, there's a laptop still recording, and they come in and
they start looking at the stuff, and one of them starts watching the tapes while the other's trying to investigate. And of course, as the tapes are progressively playing and you get to see these, things are progressively getting worse in the frame narrative as well. And I gotta say, this one for me was much, much better. VHS 2 for me is, I'm gonna tell you, it's 4 stars for me. Again, not that crazy with the found footage thing, and there were certain ones, especially in what is considered the best vignette, which is Safe Haven. That is the best received vignette, and quite frankly for me, is the best vignette. Second best one for me was Phase 1 Clinical Trials. It's just, I don't know, there's still shaky cam things that really bother me. But this stuff is just, you can see that they knew they were onto something. So I guess this is kind of where I say they did actually improve. Because again, this is coming back, this is Bloody Disgusting, again, The Collective, and now actually Haxan Films comes in. You can really see that they knew they were onto something, and that's why I think they went to production with this so quickly, because they thought that they had something that they could improve on with this. And I think they did. In nearly every aspect, the frame narrative is better. I think that the overall pacing of this movie is better. The vignettes are better. But they still, again, I don't want to say it suffers from low budget, because that's not fair. It's not fair to acknowledge that a movie is low budget and trying to do something and then hold that against it. But I think that there are still certain things in terms of acting overall that you can still achieve even within low budget. And like in the previous one, with when Tim was referring to the poor acting and the camping vignette thing, there are still some instances of that here. For me, I thought Ride in the Park, which is the second vignette, was not as well acted. I mean, I don't know how much more you can ask of it, but I just kind of got the feel for me that it was a little cheesy. So there were still some acting things that I think hurt it overall. But they improved nearly everything else. I thought that the effects were better in this one. I felt that the pacing was better. Even the frame narrative was really good. That's why I give this one 4 stars out of 5.
Same thing here. 4 out of 5 stars. Really like the variety of these shorts. It's definitely a straight contrast between each one of these. Opposed to the first one where they kind of, I don't want to say blend together, but it just kind of feels like the same thing after a while. These are just totally different from one another, different genres. However, I felt that the camera work didn't feel as authentic and in real time as I did for the first one, and I probably think because they cut the movie 4 times. Instead of like one long shot playing out or one segment playing out as one long thing with like little bitty cuts in between, but they were like cuts, like significant cuts just to progress the story. They did the same thing here, but to me it was just more of like a forced cutting, I guess. I'm really not too sure how to really explain it any more than that, but it just felt a little bit more less real-time authentic for me. Again, more of the anticipated of the horror, where the guy slowly pulls the covers back with 2 hands and you hear him breathing and, oh, because I think in real life, if you were scared and you didn't want anybody to really hear what you're saying, I understand the heavy breathing, but I don't think you'd be saying, oh my god, what the fuck, what the fuck, what the god. I think it's the first one where this happens quite a bit. The actor is actually the director and he is not a trained actor. So I kind of think that's why it's there. And I think an actor or a film shouldn't rely on the actor to produce the horror. If the story is good enough and you have the atmosphere going on and everything else happening, you don't really need anybody to instigate what the audience should be saying or what the audience should be feeling. And again, 4 out of 5 stars. More so, I love the variety, and to me that deserved the extra half star, I guess, for this one. So, very pleased with the sequel and the first one, so I'm glad we watched them.
Now that we're done with that, let's get into
This Week's Horrors.
All right,
let's jump in then. Tales from the Hood. Boy, no way that you can think what this one's going to be about, right? I mean, boy, just the title here screams authenticity. This one is an anthology, of course. All the movies are anthologies. This is from 1995. And this is basically horror. This was horror of the day and themed to be more uniquely black in perspective. These are African-American themed horror stories. It was directed by Rusty Kundieff and then executive produced by Spike Lee. So we definitely see a lot of 90s style work here being done. And it's still, however, a remake of Tales from the Crypt. And what the frame here is that it's three drug dealers and they're trying to buy some drugs from an eccentric funeral director. And he likes to tell stories about the people in there and always referring to, yes, going to get the shit, as it were. And so they tell the three stories. Rogue Cop Revelation are the names. Boys Do Get Bruised, KKK Comeuppance, and Hardcore Convert. These are the stories that are the vignettes in here. And the thing is that I think that they were trying a little too hard to be relevant to, I don't want to necessarily say the wrong group of people or whatever, but I think this was just an effort of they were trying too hard, and instead of focusing on quality, they focused on just making a movie and trying to get the movie out. And so it comes across as, overall, it's very mediocre in its acting execution. Special effects are pretty solid for the time. It just, I mean, it's just really not that great of a movie. I don't know. I think that if they had wanted to go about this project a little bit differently, instead of trying to remake Tales from the Crypt, I also think that they were trying to capitalize on the television show Tales from the Crypt as well, that was being done on HBO at the time. And instead of trying to capitalize on all that and just market to young people, they could have taken the opportunity to do just a really good movie. And it comes off as not just being poorly acted and poorly executed, it comes off as being extremely cliched. Even for the time, it comes off as being completely cliched. That's really all I have to say about it. It's not that great of a movie. I give this movie 2 stars. I did not like it. It wasn't even okay. I saw this movie when it came out, and I wasn't impressed with it then. I don't know. I think it was just a victim of the times. I think it was a victim of trying to do too many things from too many different things at a time when a lot of movies were coming out that were celebrating black culture in the 90s. And I don't know. It just didn't work. It's just simply not a good movie. This is a 2-star movie for me. I've got nothing else on this one.
This was a 1-star movie for me. It tries way too hard to be a polished, I don't want to say old-fashioned, but to be a polished anthology movie. But it fails completely with forced comedy and forced social commentary. It's less of a movie and more just trying to prove a point throughout the entire thing, so you really can't get into it. So whenever there's actually like a moment of like, ooh, that's actually pretty good camera work, or it's starting to establish a tone of some sort or a feeling of some sort, it's ruined by the comedy or just by the, again, by the social commentary. There are some good performances. The foundation story, I guess, is just stupid. I think the performances are stupid. I think the actors, the characters are just stupid, and I'm just gonna say it. I mean, it's just, I just don't buy the ending. It's like they're supposed to be these killers, but they're going to the creepy mortuary, and they're scared by it. But yet they're supposed to be hardened criminals, and one of them's like, I'm scared to go in there. Oh, it's spooky, and they're like, oh, grow a pair. Yeah, just we're going in here. No, there's no
fucking ghost gonna mess with us.
Type of thing. All I will say is just the forced commentary, and they were just trying way too hard, so 1 out of 5, yeah.
Yeah, and I will say that the framing device, what really hurts this movie more than anything else is the framing device, because did you ever see the original Tales from the Crypt from the 70s?
I've seen bits and pieces of it, yes.
Okay, well,
the framing device was updated to fit that movie, but it's almost the exact same. Very nearly a shot-for-shot remake. It was just they changed the content to fit the context of the movie. So it starts and ends virtually identically to... It's a group of people going into a mortuary, basically. Now, obviously not to buy drugs. They're just random people who come into a mortuary. And then at the end, they all go to hell. So, and again, that's just one of those things where I really think it just completely hurt the movie. There was no real good way to improve on that. And so it just kind of comes off. I don't know. All right, so 1 star for you. I was a little more generous with it. 2 stars. At this point, I don't even... Now that I'm talking about it even more, I don't know why I was more generous with it. But I'm not going to flip-flop. I'll keep it at 2 stars. Begrudgingly, I suppose. Let's move on. Black Sabbath. Okay, this is a 1963 flick here, and this is an Italian movie. And, okay, now I don't know. I guess, I mean, I was doing a little bit of research after I saw this movie, and I patently saw the American version. Did you see the Italian version subtitled, or what? Which one did you see?
I watched the American version, but I've seen the Italian version.
Okay. There are some very key differences that I never realized until I was reading the stuff, when I was looking at the stuff online. The order of the vignettes is different, and there is one particular one called The Telephone, where there are two women and they are lesbians, but in the American version, they are not. It's reshot so that there is no lesbian action. Not to say that there was, in the Italian version, I don't think there's any kind of real scenes going on. It's just... You know that they were lovers at some point. I think that really affected the movie because I didn't like that vignette so much. And I think it probably would have been better the original way. I think this is one of those, for me, I'm going to give this one 3.5 stars. It hasn't aged very well, per se, but I think that it does a very good job of setting a stage and setting kind of the ideal of what vignettes should be. Each individual story is... very unique. None of them tie together in any way, but they're definitely coming from very different directions. I think that given the style of the movies of the day, given the fact that it's Italian cinema, not American cinema, I thought that it was pretty well shot. I would say from a general audience perspective, most people would probably think of this as a B-movie, have it on in the background for a creepy horror movie night or a Halloween party or something, and would probably be pretty dismissive of it. But I think that this is a pretty important movie. I think it really kind of shows the roots of a good anthology. And especially, I mean, come on, how do you go wrong with Boris Karloff? I mean, you got Boris Karloff in this thing. This is one of his last flicks as well. I don't know. I like the vignettes. I think that, again, I will say I don't believe it's aged very well, but I still think that at its core, this is a very decent anthology movie, and especially considering for its time, and I give it 3.5 stars. I thought the Wordalak was pretty cool, personally.
Yeah, I really like how the stories play out as if you're reading a gothic novel, in a way. What's awesome about these early anthologies, and especially Italian movies, is that the key aspects of their flicks are cinematography, the look of it, and then the storyline, which usually they have great dialogue. And really key of this movie to really build the suspense, I think, is the dialogue and the look of the film. I really love how the colors over the faces like change every once in a while, to the greens, to the reds, the blues, to the yellows. It's just a wash. You know, that just goes over them. And depending on the color, it depends on the mood. And there's always a reasoning behind why something looks a certain way and why a color is being shown in the background than it is being shown in the foreground. So it has a lot of levels to it that I really liked. And again, even the Italian version, like Matt was saying, the use of the lesbian scene, the order of the scenes, how they're different. What is the first scene or the first segment in the American version is the last segment in the Italian version. And to me, that is super creepy, super, super creepy. And that is one of my favorite revelations or reveals of a creepy looking character in any film, just how the camera work just goes through the door and it goes up over the bed and you just see this creepy dead woman, this gypsy looking woman just staring at the audience, and God, just, it looks dead but yet alive at the same, it's just really awesome. So with saying that, yeah, the movie doesn't age all that well, However, I like what the movie is composed of, or composed of. So I give it 4 out of 5 stars. It's creepy. I love the way it look. I think that anybody who is into film and into and respects the early groundwork of the horror genre will get something out of this movie.
Outstanding, outstanding. All right. So then, last but not least, Trick or Treat. This one is from 2007. And this is probably one of the best anthologies I think I've ever seen. And it's not because it's the greatest movie. The special effects are okay. They're standard. I'm not going to say they're subpar. The special effects are pretty standard. The vignettes are somewhat quirky, some better than others. But what is really cool about this movie is that everything is completely interwoven. There is absolutely nothing that is not related to anything else. And so you think you're watching vignettes, and yet then you're like, oh, hey, wait a minute, that makes this part make a little bit more sense. And then you're watching it down, and you say, oh, wait, that's the guy from the first part of the movie. Holy crap, that's what's happening here. And it starts putting together a big, huge puzzle. It's still an anthology movie, but it is kind of like all these disparate roads that then converge into one big movie. And then by the time you finish the movie, the whole movie makes sense. And yet all the vignettes could still stand alone as vignettes, but they don't. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. They are all individual pieces of one big puzzle that can be taken individually or put all together. And I thought that was just completely, really super cool. This is definitely a 4-star movie for me. Solid, easy 4-star movie for me. Some of the acting for me was still pretty cheesy, and that's really what keeps it from getting any higher than a 4-star. But I mean, just the originality and the style that this thing is done, you gotta see this movie. If you've never seen this movie, this is definitely, put this on your Halloween list this year. It's current. This is only from 2007, so it's very current in terms of special effects, cinematography, the way the direction, the acting of the movie.
And it's on Netflix.
And yes, on Netflix as well. I would definitely, yeah, just please see this movie if you've never seen it before. If it's been a while, because it could have been as much as 6 years by now, definitely give this one a rewatch. It's really a cool movie. And it's not, again, it's not perfect, but it's just so damn original. You literally, by the end of the movie, you forget that you were watching an anthology. It kind of just all starts fitting together. And it's fun to watch that roll out. And if you have seen this before, this is definitely, like I would say, a perfect movie to bring someone into the horror movie fold with, because it's scary, but it's not too scary. It's somewhat gory, but it's definitely not over the top. And it's not even an hour and a half. It's less than an hour and a half long, so it's not even going to take up all that much time out of your night or out of your party time or whatever. So 4 stars for me. I like this movie. That's what I mean. Of course, it was produced by Bryan Singer, so I guess maybe that has something to do with it. But yeah, that's it. That's what I got, sir. Go ahead. What do you got?
Okay, so this is a movie I watch every Halloween, usually on Halloween. My all-time favorite Halloween-y horror-type movie. 5 out of 5 stars. This movie, it's part of my collection. God, I mean, I could praise this movie for 2 hours if I had the platform to do so. It has excellent cinematography. Love the characters. I love the relationships between the characters. It has an awesome tie-in at the end of the movie that everything just comes together beautifully. To me, nothing is hokey about this movie. None of the storylines, none of the performances, everything feels, in its own world and in its own setting, it's completely authentic. And to me, all of these amazing aspects, everything that I love about this movie, falls under the reasoning that why this movie feels like Halloween to me. And I say that because it creates that fun feeling, that anticipation of what Halloween brought to me, or how I felt on Halloween, whenever I was a kid. And even now, I still get that sense of, ooh, man, there's something spooky about this evening where I get to go out and see what kind of ghouls and goblins are walking on the streets at night, which, you know, kids dressed up, or I get to go to haunted houses or go to a Halloween party. Just stuff like that just encompasses the feeling that this movie produces with inside of me. And to me, that's more of a justification right there for this movie to be 5 stars. But on top of that, you have the great characters, you have the great storyline, you have the tie-in and all the other things I said on top of that. And man, just this movie is just beautiful to look at. How they use the atmosphere, how they use the crowd of people, how they use falling leaves throughout the movie, how they use the sound of wind and trees, and whenever they put the main character, which Sam is what they call him, the kid that always has the sucker, and his killing device is a shattered sucker, and he has the sack over the head covering what his head really is, I won't say though. You'll see him back behind of a tree, but in front of him there's a tree, there's a white picket fence, there's a patch of grass, there's a street. All of this leveling throughout the movie with what you see visually, it's just, to me, a feast for the eyes, that every time I watch it, I see a different aspect of it that just pleases me in some way. So, again, it's part of my movie collection, watch it every year. Unfortunately, this movie never made it to a mainstream theater audience. It made the film festival circuit, and it won a ton of audience awards, I think at Screamfest or something like that. But man, if you have a chance to see this movie this October at a movie theater, you've got to do it. If you don't, watch it on Netflix. It will totally be worth your time. Again, Trick or Treat, 5 out of 5.
Okay. Well, I believe that takes care of everything. So we are down to the end. The next week's flicks are going to be Carrie, and then we're going to go ahead and knock out the Body Snatchers series. Yes, we are looking at all the remakes of the 1950s classic Invasion of the Body Snatchers. We're going to be looking at Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978, Body Snatchers from 1993, and The Invasion from 2007. We will probably, just for kicks, make sure to watch the 50s one too. We've both seen versions of these different... We're familiar with all these movies already, so this is kind of going back over material we've seen just to kind of get a fresh perspective on it. So feel free to jump in on all of them, or just a couple of them, or none of them. Because, you know, we'll talk about them anyway. And given that there's been this many versions of this movie, I would just go ahead and expect spoiler alerts all around. The 3 squared again for next week is going to be our favorite horror franchise, and then we're going to pick... We're not going to let the whole franchise go. We're going to pick our 3 favorites from that franchise. I think, though, then that should be it. Is that not correct, sir?
Spiel on.
All right, here is the spiel. Bonus here. The horror music that you've been listening to was provided by Rising Game, courtesy of Kevin McLeod from Incompetech.com. It's licensed under the Creative Commons of Attribution 3.0. All right, you can go to creativecommons.org and check that out there. The other music that you've been listening to, of course, not our discussion music, but the rock music that you hear is courtesy of our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at reverbnation.com. MySpace.com and Facebook.com/CriesOfSolace. As far as we are concerned, well, we're still the SLS Cast, and you can go to SLScast.com. Check us out there. You can always follow us on Twitter at the SLS Cast. Send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. And go to Facebook, search us there, and of course, follow us on iTunes. And until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Steve Guttenberg, I get to say this. If you put down a list of jobs, doctor, lawyer, janitor, teacher, or movie star, everybody would pick the movie star. And why? So you could lie around the pool, drink margaritas, and send money to your parents. So that's what I did.
And if you guys made it this far into the podcast, this is Tim saying cheers.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.